You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
this individual left Liberia, arrived in the US, had no symptoms, but began to develop symptoms, was admitted to a hospital in Texas and placed on isolation.
The Ebola virus reaches the United States as American soldiers prepare to head in the opposite direction to tackle the outbreak in West Africa. Martin Plaut and Brett Mason will join me to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Australia's somewhat semi-baked new counter-terrorism laws.
This bill comprehensively modernises and improves the legislation governing the activities of the Australian intelligence community. This legislation has been put through a very significant amount of community consultation.
Well, that's one way of putting it. We'll also be speaking to our man in Belgrade and reviewing the week's new dance openings. All that and more, and music besides, coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
Student demonstrators in Hong Kong are vowing to step up their protests unless the territory's leader does not step down. They've threatened to start occupying government buildings unless their demands are met. Thousands more have joined protesters demanding Beijing drop plans to vet candidates for elections in 2017, committing instead to a fully democratic process. Chan Kin Man from the Occupy Central movement says there is a way to end the protests.
If they can give a sincere answer to our questions, to our demands, I believe the occupation will end. That is, CY Leung has to step down immediately and then give Hong Kong an opportunity to discuss about constitutional reform again.
Two attacks in the rebel-held city of Donetsk have further threatened a fragile ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. 10 people died, 6 when a minibus was shelled, and 4 more in an attack on a school playground. It's almost a month since the truce between government forces and pro-Russian rebels began, but there have been sporadic attacks throughout that time. Meanwhile, NATO's new leader has warned Russia not to make the situation in Ukraine any worse. Jens Stoltenberg was speaking after taking over as Secretary General.
The ceasefire in Ukraine offers an opportunity, but Russia maintains its ability to destabilize Ukraine, and Russia remains in breach of international law.
There have been further airstrikes against Islamic State militants in northern Syria. They targeted fighters near the border town of Kobane. Tens of thousands have fled from there into Turkey. The Turkish parliament has been asked to approve further action against IS, which could involve the country's troops crossing into Syria or Iraq, as well as allowing other countries to use Turkish bases in their operations against the militants. A patient with the first confirmed case of Ebola diagnosed on US soil is in an isolation unit in Texas. Officials say there are no other suspected cases in the state, and the ambulance crew that treated him tested negative for the virus. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has said it's hoping to begin small-scale use of 2 experimental Ebola vaccines early next year in West Africa, where more than 3,000 people have so far died from the disease. The former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has told his war crimes trial he did not order killings during the 1990s. But he's also said he takes moral responsibility for the crimes committed by others during the Bosnian War. Mr. Karadzic has been making closing statements in his trial in The Hague, where he faces a series of charges, including genocide over the Srebrenica massacre, in which thousands of Muslim men and boys were murdered. Nigeria's president has insisted his army is turning the tide against Islamist militants. He says there have been a series of advances against Boko Haram, who've taken large parts of the north of Nigeria. Goodluck Jonathan has faced criticism for his failure to find 200 girls abducted by Boko Haram earlier this year. But in a televised address, he said the military is pushing back against the Islamists.
They have remained undaunted and unwearied in the face of constant challenge and mortal danger, driven by patriotic zeal, They are turning the tides by their prowess and determination. As Commander-in-Chief, I will continue to do all it takes to enable them to keep on inflicting devastating blows at the hearts of terror.
It's emerged President Obama rode in a lift with an armed security contractor with convictions for assault. News of the security lapse, which happened in a government building in Atlanta, comes after the head of the Secret Service was questioned by Congress over another security breach at the White House. On that occasion, an Iraq war veteran scaled a fence, evaded agents, and managed to get inside the building. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1806 in London. We'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, now nearly 1807 in London, which will be 1807 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news for the first half of the show, here in the studio are Martin Plaut, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Brett Mason, Europe Correspondent for Australia's Special Broadcasting Service. Welcome both. We will start in the United States, where the first case of the Ebola virus has been confirmed in a patient at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. The man is believed recently returned from Liberia. This naturally means that America's more excitable news networks are currently predicting an imminent zombie apocalypse. But what does it actually mean for what is now the worst Ebola outbreak ever recorded? Martin, I'll start with you. It's not actually entirely surprising, is it, that this has fetched up in Dallas in particular, where Texas being a place where lots of flights to and from West Africa do go?
Well, I'm frankly just surprised we haven't had it spread to other places as well. Why hasn't it arrived in Britain? Why has it not spread to, shall we say, South Africa or France? There are lots of flights landing with lots of people from Liberia. It does suggest that the screening must be pretty good. What was insane about this was that the guy, you know, complained about being ill, went to, medical facilities, and they didn't take him in and do anything. That was the real disaster. But, it's not a big deal, quite frankly, the fact that it is in America, as long as he hasn't been in contact and close contact with a lot of people. It's not that infectious. Unless you actually touch somebody who's deeply involved, you know, whose body fluids are falling apart in front of you, and you get his body fluids, then it's very infectious. But you can't get it like flu.
Brett, there have been other people treated for the Ebola virus in the United States, aid workers who've come back from West Africa and who have survived, although that's not to belittle what I'm sure was a horrifying experience. But is the Ebola story in general, is it another story of Africans essentially dying from bad infrastructure?
Well, I think that the encouraging thing is that there has been some measured reporting of this incident. I think that was my biggest fear when I saw this, that, as you say, that apocalypse would be being reported everywhere. But I think it's, if nothing else, a blessing in the sense that perhaps more Americans will begin to care about this story and will do more to help. This is the worst Ebola outbreak in modern history. 3,000 people have lost their lives. One person in America is sick, and suddenly it's headline news. I think that the issue is beyond one of infrastructure. It's a very problematic situation to achieve a lot of things in Africa, not through any desire not to help, but simply how do you achieve that? And we've seen the extraordinary vision of people leaving isolation wards, having to be chased down through market squares and return to receive treatment. So there are many challenges there, and it's one where you simply can't go marching in and suddenly sanitize an entire nation.
Martin, on that subject of people going to help or things being done to help, 3,000 US troops are now en route in what's being called Operation United Assistance. Is this, as it will doubtless be sold, the US actually acting entirely altruistically?
Well, I think that's an extremely good question. And it's one I've been asking. It's one I've been asking myself. I mean, you mustn't forget that they're actually under AFRICOM, the Africa Command. And AFRICOM has been lusting after a West African base for a long time. They say they're going to spend $1 billion. It doesn't seem to me like that's only going to be doing, shall we say, healthcare. So I think it will provide the Americans with the opportunity to establish a much firmer foothold in Liberia. Liberia has been one of the countries that's quite keen to have an American military presence there. So I think this is a happy synergy for the Americans. Having said that, I mean, I think it is fantastic they are going in. The only other nation that's really put a lot of people in are the Cubans, who put in about 300. And the big question really is, where are the Chinese? You know, they're supposed to be Africa's big best friend. Well, where the hell are they?
An entirely fair question, and also, I guess, vaguely heartwarming to see the Cubans and the United States on the same side. And Brett, I wanted to pick up that point you made there earlier. You were talking about those cases of, you know, people fleeing the clinics and having to be sort of forcibly returned. There's been obviously worse cases in Guinea in particular, where you saw aid workers actually being set upon and lynched. How big a factor in the spread of this has been, I guess, a lack of trust between the local populations and the governments and the NGOs, trying to tell them, no, seriously, this is a thing and this is how we deal with it?
Oh, it's a huge problem, and it's like a lot of the other issues we've seen there, where there are cultural considerations, where there are people who believe that that it's not so much a case of medicine or disease, that it's some fate or some sort of part of their outcome, as opposed to being something that can be contracted and treated, and they're very, very sensitive things. And I've been there to Africa, a lot of African nations, covering one story in particular, and that's immunization. And there are a lot of villagers who are very resistant to any form of Western white medicine because they don't understand it. It's to them unfathomable. So to suddenly see men arriving en masse in white masks and setting up big white it is a very unfamiliar thing for these people. And there are certain cultural considerations, but also, as you say, the trust is also another factor there. And, I think we can talk about America's intentions, and I'm sure that commentary is right, but ultimately, we all have a vested interest in stopping the spread of this disease. If it saves one life, in my opinion, it's worth it.
That same point to you, Martin, it is a very, very good one. I've spoken to people, especially trying to treat HIV in Africa, and they run up against the same problem, that a lot of the people that they deal with and whom they're trying to help simply don't believe them. And this is now a decades-old problem. What trick is being missed here?
Well, I think there are a number of things. I mean, the one thing is that the whole epidemic, could potentially spiral completely out of control, because, I mean, the worst case scenario is 1.4 million people infected and possibly dying by January. So it is absolutely vital we get on top of it. On the other hand, it's not quite as insane as, it might appear when people are resistant to, white medicine arriving in and suggesting that you should just accept it. After all, one shouldn't forget that the Nigerians had a very bad experience where there were companies which were coming in there and dishing out medicines and using Africans as, guinea pigs to see whether they worked. And this, you only have to do it a couple of times, the word gets around like a fire. And, it is people get very, very resistant to it. On top of which, of course, Liberia and that part of Africa believes in voodoo. Well, I mean, if you believe in voodoo, you can believe in anything.
Well, the good news, I suppose, before we move on, is that the CDC in the US says the virus is now contained in Nigeria and Senegal. We will take a look further south now, where, to the surprise of very few onlookers, ANC MPs have moved to absolve President Jacob Zuma of any malfeasance pertaining to the state-funded refurbishment of his private home, which, following what were described as security upgrades, now includes a swimming pool and an amphitheatre, among other accoutrements vital to his personal protection. Martin, you really can't write this stuff. Could you fill us in a bit on the background of the Nkandla scandal, as it's known?
Well, it's just another mess that Zuma has got the ANC into. And, the African National Congress, which has a proud history, 100 years plus of, fighting against apartheid and racism. And now they are, frankly, deep in the mire. And Candler is only the latest of the scandals that Zuma has got them into. You may remember that he allowed his pals, the Guptas, to fly into the Waterkloof Air Base. In fact, they frankly took it over. This is the main Air Force base of the country, and the defense minister said, you may not come. And they just said, oh, as if, and arrived. And then, you know, hired guards to take them through to the area where they were going to have a good time. I mean, it's just outrageous. And there is one scandal after another. Now, frankly, he'd be a goner in the ANC if it wasn't for the fact that he is in charge of the one key committee, which is the deployment committee. So they take everybody that they think are good eggs, and he's the one who decides you are going to go to that job. So he's dished out the jobs. And so everybody in the ANC who's important owes his position or her position to Mr. Zuma. So he's got his pals around him.
Because this story strikes me as one of those cases of being not so much a politician who doesn't know how bad something looks, but who simply doesn't care.
I think that he does care in a funny kind of way, but he just, you know...
A very funny kind of
well,
way.
Well, let me give you one example. When I spoke to somebody who knew him when he was in exile, and there are not many people who remembered him from exile, when, of course, he was in charge of their security operation, the ANC's internal security operation, and probably has blood on his hands from that, although we have no proof of that. But, you know, people said he would just arrive in an area and he would take over. But he wasn't worried about money. Money was other people's problems. He dealt with politics. And that's always been his attitude. Money is neither here nor. You must look after me. I expect you to look after me very well. But really, it's not my issue. I'm looking after the politics. Don't bother me. It's a bit like the Queen.
Brett, do you think, I mean, is this the kind of thing that's a consequence of that for all that South Africa is a democracy, it's also effectively a one-party state? Is this the kind of thing that is just inevitably going to occur when people just get used to the idea that power is something they're entitled to?
Well, sometimes I think so. I think in any nation, when you have any one party or individual in power, be it legitimate or otherwise, for a long period of time, you're open to that abuse of office. And I think for me, the last time I was in South Africa was following the death of Nelson Mandela, someone who, you know, we all know, I don't need to sit here and tell you what an effect he had. But seeing his protege of sorts booed at his funeral, I think shows you the huge divide, and going into places like Soweto where they're deeply embarrassed and ashamed of their president. And that was, for me, overwhelming to see people talk about how their own party, their party of all people, betraying them and their trust. There is so much anger there. And I think that what I can't fathom in South Africa is how that happens for a party that's grassroots is all about inequality, and it's about all these wonderful things, yet it's become a beast, really. And you, when you see this ridiculous justification of security measures and what we're seeing happening there, it's not even well disguised. As you say, it's quite overt, and someone who doesn't care. And how the party's changed from what it was to what it now is, I think I cannot fathom. I really can't. It's beyond words for me.
It's simple. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Indeed. It's no more complicated
indeed
than that.
Indeed it does. We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Martin Plout and Brett Mason. When we return, we'll be looking at Australia's response to ISIS at home and abroad, and Iran's sudden largesse towards the military of Lebanon.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Martin Plaut from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Brett Mason from Australia's Special Broadcasting Service. And we will look now at Australia, the homeland of two of the people in this room. It has been one of the most distant, but one of the more enthusiastic participants in the US-led coalition, currently flying around Iraq and Syria trying to find ISIS-related targets to blow up. Royal Australian Air Force surveillance planes were due to begin non-combat missions today, with a decision about sending up their FA-18s due. Back home, Parliament has passed new counter-terrorism laws. Brett, briefly and basically, what powers do these new laws give and to whom?
Well, they're quite extraordinary, and many Australians, I don't think, are aware of what's happened overnight in the Australian Parliament. Essentially, they're tougher laws for our security services. So ASIO and ASIS, the equivalent of MI5 and MI6, really looking at domestic and international terrorism, essentially increased powers for surveillance against citizens, tougher penalties for those who leak or publish or disclose those types of documents. But the government is looking to pass much tougher laws, which would include detaining anyone, including Australian citizens, whether they're suspected of being involved in terrorist acts or otherwise. There are also tougher penalties for the media who reveal details of those terror operations. There's now, if you like, a blanket ban. So very interesting and, for Australia, I guess, uncharted laws about how the media can operate in this new landscape. The government's really downplaying it, saying it's not about journalism, it's not about media, it's about terrorism. But how we operate under these new laws is yet to be tested. And I think there's a lot of nervousness and also anger in Australia, particularly in the media landscape, about what this means and what we can and can't report, and effectively what role the media plays. You know, the Prime Minister's spoken recently about being on Team Australia, and what that means for us, and what is now deemed as not only being un-Australian but also illegal, is a very fine line.
I think you're never in an entirely good place when somebody starts putting the prefix un in front of your nationality. But staying with that, aside from the media reaction in Australia, who appear to be reacting quite rightly, as journalists usually do in such circumstances, what's your sense of the mood among the public? Because whenever I go back to Australia, which I try to do once a year or so, I'm always struck not just by how physically detached it is from the rest of the world, and at the end of 28 hours on a plane, you're in no doubt about that. But actually, you know, sort of, I don't know what the right word is, spiritually, newsily, but, you know, things seem like they're all happening a terribly, terribly long way away. Is that still the sense that you get as to how the Australian public feels about this?
Absolutely. And I think that we're insular geographically, politically, and socially in many senses.
Politically was the adverb I wanted. Thank you. Strategically, it was something like that.
But I think that more and more Australians are interested and wanting to know what's happening in the world and the context, the global context in which these domestic decisions are being made. But absolutely, I find the same as you when I go home and I watch the news and these stories, 20 seconds just after the painting panda from San Diego and just before the weather. But what...
Don't knock the painting panda from San Diego. That was big.
But I think that more and more Australians now, when they learn about these laws, will be wanting to know why they're of consequence. I mean, they just seem extraordinary for a nation that has no direct... We had these terror raids, 2 weeks ago now, which were big news and resulted in one arrest, despite hours of blanket coverage. I think people are wising up and beginning to ask a lot of questions about why are these decisions being made in Australia, and they're looking to learn more about what's happening. But I think the thing that surprises me is the political conversation we're having now, which you would have noticed in recent times, about banning the burqa, the Prime Minister's comments today regarding that. It seems like a time warp, which is, I was stepping back 10 years and repeating a conversation we had that is very, very divisive. And what I notice more and more is that there seems to be this regurgitation of very divisive arguments. And when we see laws like this coming into effect, people begin to it's sort of this fear culture, and I don't know what's happened, what's brought that about, when we have no intelligence of any specific threat, yet we're approving all of these very serious laws that impact, you know, effectively the government can now impede or dictate how people live their life under house arrest as part of these terror prevention measures. It seems to me... we're going to go there again, but for a nation that prides itself on being young and free, these laws are very different to what I imagined ever being in place in the country that I call home.
Martin, there is a general point here, which appears to be that the Western world has learnt almost nothing from the last 13 years of dealing with an Islamist threat, which clearly exists. I mean, Tony Abbott's rhetoric about ISIS has been fairly rugged. But he hasn't been wrong. He called them an apocalyptic death cult, which is not unfair, and who want heads on stakes. And, you know, they have. The evidence suggests that that is a thing they're interested in. But why is it, do you think, that Western governments... They seem unable to just sort of treat their people like they're intelligent human beings. They can, you know, I've never understood why they can't just say, look, there are terrible things happening a long way from us, which we can probably go and fix. And so should we do that?
Well, I think there are two things I would say. First of all, you know, I would hate to be the Home Minister or Interior Minister of any country, because can you imagine those folders coming across your desk? And they must be every day.
Of course.
Day. And in fact, a couple of times
And if
a day,
something does go wrong...
It came across your desk.
It came across
your desk. And you did nothing.
That's the problem. Australians are paying the price for this political butt covering, and that's effectively what it is. Let's say that we've done something, even if it's not necessarily the right thing. At least we tried. We did something.
But just let me come to the other thing which I want to say, which was, this reminds me of Niger, which may be an odd take on it. But
not something that gets said about Australia often, but,
no, but
let's see where you're going with this.
Do you remember somebody called Plame Wilson?
I do, yes.
Yes. CIA agent in Niger who said there was no uranium going to, I think it was Iran?
Somewhere like that,
or Libya,
yes.
Iraq, I can't remember.
Somewhere of that sort.
And guess what? It was illegal for anybody to ever out a CIA agent. Just the kind of thing that the Australians have. Guess who outed them? It was Scooter Libby and Karl Rove, President Bush's own advisors. So wait for the blowback. It's sure to come.
No doubt at all. Finally, though, staying in the Middle East, Iran sending guns to Lebanon. It doesn't at first glance look like news. They have, of course, been doing it for decades. But a new tranche of shipments will be going not to Tehran's proxy militia, Hezbollah, but to Lebanon's official army in order to enable them to confront non-state militias, with the presumable exception of Iran's friends in the Party of God. Martin, what does this tell us, that Iran and now sort of, they seem now to regard Lebanon as a kind of a bulwark against ISIS from the rear, if I'm reading the strategies and the maps right.
I think what it must show us is that, you know, a Shia nation like Iran is just now really, really worried about the growing strength of a Sunni organization like Islamic State. And, you know, they begin to think they've got to pull out all the stops and put weapons into even the hands of people, frankly, with whom they don't have a lot in common. But then, quite frankly, the Washington's doing the same. They begin to cozy up to President Assad and thinking, maybe there's something to this bastard after all. I mean, he may be a bastard, but at least he might one day be our bastard.
Again. Yeah. I've asked a few other people in this slot, and I'll ask you now, Brett. I try to be optimistic about things from time to time. I almost start to wonder whether ISIS unwittingly are on the verge of bringing about some sort of Middle Eastern grand bargain, because they have accomplished what I don't think anybody else who's tried in the Middle East in the last 3,000 years has done. They've got everybody else on the same side.
Maybe it's some secret United Nations mission to bring the world closer together.
I'm sure you can find people in the bazaars of Beirut willing to tell you exactly that, by the way.
Look, I think, if we rewound the 18 months, 2 years, and said that we would see these types of alliances taking place, particularly between Syria and the United States, people might be look at you like you're a little crazy. So I see where you're coming from in that respect. But it's interesting how much of an impact IS has managed to have in, say, 6 months. You know, we've been looking at all these other conflicts that have been going on, and it's as if the world was sort of ignoring what was happening. And now it's the only thing we're talking about, Ukraine off the radar. Syria off the radar to the extent of what was initially going on there.
Libya entirely forgotten.
Absolutely, even though there are still huge issues confronting that nation. So I'm intrigued with the IS sort of public relations program and how they've managed to really dominate the headlines and get their message out there. I mean, obviously these video messages have had a huge impact, and it seems to have caught a lot of nations off guard, particularly the UK, in, as to how they respond and deal with that very, very public. I mean, obviously with these other nations, there was backroom diplomacy, all of those military actions that were taking place, whereas IS has seemed to have, you know, used very simple technology. Western technology, you know, Twitter, YouTube, those types of things. And that's what really interests me, how they've managed to cut through
plus
all these
the
other conflicts.
Knife.
Yeah, well, that's right, of course.
We will have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you both very much. Martin Plout and Brett Mason, thanks for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monaco 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Loads still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be hearing from our man in Belgrade. We'll find out about a new organisation representing French Algerians and review the latest dance openings. But before all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
Student demonstrators in Hong Kong say they will step up their protests unless the territory's leader resigns. They threaten to start occupying government buildings tomorrow unless their demands are met. Thousands more have joined protesters, demanding Beijing drop plans to vet candidates for elections in 2017 and instead commit to a fully democratic process. Two attacks in the rebel-held city of Donetsk have put more pressure on eastern Ukraine's fragile ceasefire. 10 people died, 6 when a minibus was shelled, 4 more in an attack on a school playground. It's now almost a month since the truce between government forces and pro-Russian rebels began. There have been further airstrikes against Islamic State militants in northern Syria. They targeted fighters near a town close to the border with Turkey, where tens of thousands have fled. The Turkish parliament, meanwhile, has been asked to approve further action against IS. That could involve the country's troops crossing into Syria or Iraq. And a patient with the first confirmed case of Ebola diagnosed on U.S. soil is in an isolation unit in Texas. Officials say there are no other suspected cases in the state. The ambulance crew that treated him tested negative. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has said it's hoping to begin small-scale use of 2 experimental Ebola vaccines by the beginning of next year in West Africa. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24, 21:33 nearish enough in Moscow, which will be 18:33 in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to the Serbian capital, from where we're joined by our man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay. Guy, welcome to the show. We're actually starting not in Belgrade, but in The Hague, where Radovan Karadzic, who listeners may remember, is still on trial. What's going on?
Well, Radovan Karadzic has been on trial since 2008. Well, at least that was when his first court appearances happened. And it's been a long time getting to this point. He was the former leader of the Bosnian Serbs, became, of course, infamous in the early 90s as the face in the way of the Bosnian conflict. And he's charged with genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. And the major headline internationally has always been the genocide in connection with the Srebrenica massacre in 1995. Well, after this terribly long international criminal process in The Hague at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, we're finally at the point this week of getting the closing arguments from both the prosecution and the defence. The prosecution had their moment earlier in the week. Today and tomorrow, it's Karadzic.
And how much attention is still being paid to this in Serbia? Does Karadzic and his like still have a constituency, or is it something people think is embarrassing, happened a long time ago, don't really want to think about it anymore?
I think increasingly it's the latter, Andrew. I mean, certainly what people always feel about the ICTY, the Hague Tribunal, is that it's very good at prosecuting crimes by Serbs or allegedly committed by Serbs, but not very good at committing crimes that were committed against Serbs. And more Serbs were ethnically cleansed during the conflict than any other ethnicity, but very, very few convictions have been made for those crimes. So people here have tended to basically stop watching it. They think the Hague Tribunal is a bit of a put-up job, and you'd be struggling to find headlines about Karadzic in the Belgrade press this evening or tomorrow morning.
So what are the chances of some sort of verdict being returned before he, as Milosevic did before him, sort of cheats justice by dying?
Well, this is the whole thing. At least Karadzic looks healthy. His quiff is back in place. He's clean-shaven these days. He's no longer pretending to be a New Age healer, which is what he did for many years while he was in hiding in New Belgrade, of all places, before he was finally discovered. So it doesn't look like he's about to peg it before the verdict. Having said that, 6 years on, we're going to have probably at least another year to wait before the judges rule on whether he'll be convicted of genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. International justice seems to take a horrendously long time, which isn't particularly good for all the people who suffered during those years.
We did talk about moving along. We did talk, I think, last week about whether or not a 21st century European capital was going to manage to hold a gay pride march. What actually happened?
Well, this is the amusing thing, is that Belgrade did indeed manage to hold a gay pride march, but there were more police, many more, I would say probably about 6 to 8 times more police policing the gay pride march than there were people actually taking part of it. 7,000 police on duty, a few hundred marchers going from a very short distance in Belgrade from one set of government buildings to another. You couldn't get through this police cordon without the correct ID. And why I say it was amusing, at least the black comedy, was that the Prime Minister's brother, Andrei Vučić, brother of Prime Minister Alexander, discovered if you try and go through a cordon of heavily armed and cheesed off gendarmerie, they may beat you very severely indeed. And that's precisely what happened to Andrei Vučić. Took a severe beating at the hands of the gendarmerie, and the ructions are ongoing.
What has been the press response, not just to that, but to the fact that the march happened? And you know, It's actually hard to know whether it's a good thing that it happened in the circumstances that you describe, because a parade in which you have to deploy that many police in order to protect that few paraders sort of suggests that your city is one not entirely at ease with itself where this issue is concerned.
I think we're sort of in transit between two paradigms here, one of Serbia as it used to be and one of Serbia as it might be in a decade or so's time. And this is a nudge in the right direction. I think now that we've got one Belgrade Pride march that's gone down, and Andrei Vučić aside, went down peacefully, that perhaps in future years things will be able to liven up, broaden out, and people will start to see it more as part of the fabric of Belgrade. The fact is, the legislation is there. This isn't a country which has laws against homosexuality. In fact, the consent laws are rather more liberal than a lot of Western European countries. It's attitudes that have been poor. You're not really going to change those attitudes by having a completely closed off march that nobody can see, and that's what a lot of the marchers were saying. But to get one down, to get one through that's gone peacefully, that's a marker that can be built upon in succeeding years.
Finally, though, Guy, there's apparently due to be a slightly better attended and possibly less controversial parade in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. Back to our old friend Vladimir Putin, who, of course, is a great friend of Serbia. Serbia often looks up to Russia as its big brother in a way. They're brothers in Orthodox Christianity and the use of Cyrillic script, among many other things. And President Putin will be visiting Belgrade on October the 16th. And just to coincide with his visit, they're going to have the largest military parade this country has seen since the 1980s, when, depending on whom you ask, this was either a socialist or a communist country.
What can we expect from the parade? Is it going to be one of those old school ones with lots of red banners and people carrying placards with big pictures of gout-ridden communist grandees on them?
Do you know what I'm hoping for? I'm hoping for those missiles on the back of trucks where they've actually painted the sides of the wheels white, yeah, just to look nice and smart. I'm hoping we're going to get that sort of thing.
Seriously, though, will there be people in Serbian politics and people in Serbia generally a bit worried about how this might look? Because Serbia obviously does have ambitions of becoming an EU nation at some stage. Vladimir Putin, not currently the EU's favourite human being.
No, Serbia's got this really delicate balancing act that's going on. They are in formal negotiations to join the European Union. Accession talks started in January. But at the same time, they don't want to give up their long-standing ties with Russia. So this is all part of the balancing act. One week you put through a gay pride march which displays your tolerance credentials to the European Union. A couple of weeks later, you say, hello, Vladimir, and you stage a great big military parade in his honour. At some point, history has told us these balancing acts have to come to an end, and sometimes they come to quite a sticky end indeed.
Guy Delaunay, thanks as ever for joining us. That was Guy Delaunay speaking to us from Belgrade. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Nobody's quite sure how many French Algerians there are. The ruthlessly secular French Republic does not sort its citizens by colour or faith. But there is no doubt that many who do identify as French Algerian feel underrepresented, underengaged, and lacking the opportunities available to many of their fellow citizens. Hoping to change all that is an organisation called the Organisation of French Algerian Republicans, which acronymises into French, which is not a language you want to hear me try speaking, as FAR, F-A-R-R. Earlier, I spoke to Fadia Massoud.
This organization that stands for a Franco-Algerian Republican or Association of French Algerian Republican aims to federate French Algerian who are attached to their Algerian roots, but who also are strongly attached to their French citizenship, since they constructed their lives in France and wish to live their biculturalism in harmony. So as such, we would like to be represented in the public debate because we are a majority of us and we often feel that our voice is not heard enough.
In what particular respects or in what particular areas do you feel that French Algerians aren't properly represented?
Well, I mean, culturally, we have to show our culture, our roots. History has to be revisited. We have to speak and to be more involved in the public debate. Many, many areas.
I guess as well as trying to participate in the general conversation, have you been organising specific events as well, like cultural events?
Very much so, yes. We actually, last year, we have our guest of honour, the great Raleigh Benchir. He is the president of the Global Conference of Religions for Peace. He took part in a seminar at the Arab World Institute in Paris, and he lectured about Arabo-Andalusian history and covered a large span of history from the origin of Islam until the geopolitics of today. We also organized a lecture series in the Café de Flore in Paris. You know, it used to be Sartre's second home back then. And we wanted actually to revisit our history that unfortunately has been confiscated for too long of a time. And we would like also through that to invite historians to undertake a research project with archives that also have been still today confiscated by both countries. We also would like, and this is actually a musical venue to come next spring, and we would like to promote North African Andalusian artists and musicians in those venues. One artist who is a renowned artist and musician, Fawzi Abdel Nour, will be performing. And of course, our gala in February, which is an annual gala where all parties of French political class will be invited, and where we will be giving out awards to members of the community with outstanding achievements.
Especially for those new generations you mentioned, how complicated is that dual identity now between being French and Algerian? As you say, there's an extremely complicated and often tragic history between the two countries. Is it still that difficult a thing to live with, being both French and Algerian?
Well, it is difficult in the suburbs. You know, we have a lot of North African descents in France who are, I would say, disadvantaged and living in suburbs. And social economics are parts of the problem, I would say, more than anything. And this is why we want to help them. But a lot of us are very well integrated and live our culture fully, both cultures fully. This is why we decided and we took upon ourselves to educate this youth who is disadvantaged and live in the suburbs of France, and to be able to integrate them with culture, education more, so they could be part of the social picture in France.
And do you sort of make an effort to remain above any political considerations, or do you embrace those differences as well?
Well, I mean, we are an apolitical association. We are not involved in any political parties, and we bring together anyone, and we don't want to have an affiliation with any parties.
That was Fadia Massoud from FAR speaking to me earlier. You can find out more at www.associationfar.siteww.fr. It's time now for some music. We'll stay with the Algerian theme for this one. This is Rashid Taha with his version of a song you may just about be familiar with. Rashid Taha with his version of The Clash's Rock the Casbah. You listen to Midori House on Monocle 24. Regular listeners will be aware that we already have bureaus in a multiplicity of locations, including Toronto, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Zurich. We now have another one in Istanbul, from where I am joined by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, welcome to the show.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Tell us about the bureau. Where is it? What does it look like? What can you see out of the windows?
We're very fortunate with the space we've got. We've moved into the Vault Karakoy, which is a new hotel set up in an old Ottoman era bank. We've got a lovely space on the ground floor. And I think, as you say, you know, it's important that we've added to the number of bureaus. This is number 6 now, and it allows us to do more stories around the world, the sort of stories that you don't just Google, you don't just find out by looking online, but you actually get by meeting people and hearing stories and seeing what's happening on the ground. And this bureau, like the others, will help us bring more fascinating stories from across Turkey.
And what kind of, I guess, commemorative events are planned?
We've had a big event tonight to launch it with about 150 to 200 people, business people, design people, architects, fashion designers, journalists as well, we're journalists, a few diplomats as well. So it's sort of a real sort of mix of people from across all walks of life in Istanbul. And then we're also doing an edition of the Foreign Desk, which will come out this weekend, looking at the state of Turkey. And Joseph Day, our new bureau chief here, has certainly seems to have a rather large stack of business cards and lots of ideas purely from this event tonight.
You may have picked, obviously, a remarkably well-timed moment to be doing a special edition of the Foreign Desk from Istanbul. Do you know yet what kind of things you'll be talking about?
We're going to be doing a bit of an overview following the elections back in August, which saw Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan turn into President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, looking at what's changed. And obviously there'll be a big discussion about Turkey's foreign policy when you look at where Turkey is in the world. You know, it's old Prime Minister Fitzalude famously said he wanted zero problems in the neighbourhood. Well, he certainly didn't get that. There's a 600-mile border with Syria, there's a border with Iraq, there's a border with Iran, and all three of those countries are causing Turkey some degree of problems, I think it's fair to say, at the moment. So we'll be talking about ISIS, we'll be talking about the crisis in Syria, and of course also Turkey's relationship with the European Union.
With that, Steve, I shall leave you to enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll look forward to that edition of the Foreign Desk this weekend. That's Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, speaking from our new bureau office in Istanbul. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, the week's new openings in dance.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luscombe. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
There are lots of chunky themes running through the new October issue of Monocle. We survey the world of modern diplomacy and publish our fresh-faced guide to Auckland and New Zealand.
In the design section, we head to Greece to report on a new wave of architects that has come out of the crisis with a newfound patriotism. And then we cozy on down in two jealous-making homes, a Bauerhaus villa in Alsace and a summer house in Menorca.
In the edit section, we check out an age-old Portuguese porcelain maker building a business to last and sit down with Martha Stewart for her perfect meal.
The October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Why not become a subscriber? Head to monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to Midori House, coming up for 1853 in London, and time now as we head for the end of the show for our daily arts review. Today we're talking dance with, once again, author and critic Louise Levine. Louise, welcome back to the programme. The first thing you wanted to talk about tonight, and I do think the producers do this on purpose, is keep bringing in things with French names, which they just enjoy making me try to read out. And I'm not going to do it. So could you please tell us what this production's called?
It's called Séquence 8, I assume. It's Les Sept Doigts de la Main. They come from Canada.
Easy for you
and,
to say.
It's easy for me to say, yeah. O-level and everything. They've actually changed their name to Seven Fingers for touring purposes, so they're with you there.
Okay.
And they have a show which has been running at the Peacock Theatre for the last few weeks. It's on until Sunday. And it's a circus show kind of dressed up as dance theatre. So there's rather more chat than you'd want. Certain amount of postmodern, why are we doing this stuff?
Oh, God.
And then some stunts. And the stunts are fine. But it goes on for 2 hours, which is a very long time. And I have a kind of, you know, my boredom threshold is quite low when it comes to circus. And it's, you know, circus is like a box of chocolates. I mean, you know, you do know what you're going to get. But some of it is so delicious you want to go into the second layer. Some of it gets half eaten and left in the ashtray. And, you know, it varies, depends how old you are. You know, when I was a kid, I liked watching the clowns get in and out of their little car.
Are there any clowns getting in and out of little cars?
No. There's a lot of postmodern rabbit. You know, they chat.
But, there's no Alka-Seltzer bottles, squirty cream things.
No, none of that.
Lions and a guy with a whip and a chair.
Much more anarchic and modern than that.
Okay.
But they do have some very nice stunts, as all circuses do. I mean, Cirque du Soleil, which goes on for several days every time I've ever been to see it. You know, there'll be one person juggling with hats that will, you know, blow your mind.
No, see, I have a huge, huge tolerance for that kind of stuff. I mean, I've been to see even, I remember once seeing the Chinese state circus, or what was billed as the Chinese state circus, in front of a crowd of about 15 bored package tourists in Beijing, and it was just awesome.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing. Yes. Because they just did, you know, completely impossible things for an hour.
You have to do impossible things.
Yeah.
This is the absolute given. You've got to juggle with more hats than you've ever seen
Lots
in your
hats.
Life. Or you've got to, I remember the Moscow state circus, there was a man came up with his enormous wife, tall I mean, and he picked her up by the ankle and just with one arm placed her over his head. And she was like a column of flesh, and they were standing there, all 12 foot of them. It was unbelievable.
See,
Very simple.
I can watch that sort of stuff all night.
Zippo's circus, who go around the parks of the world, I think, have got a thing called the Globe of Death. which is...
What's not to love?
Exactly. I mean, you're there with me, aren't you? And it's a 14-foot diameter steel cage. Man comes out on a motorbike, gets in, starts looping the loop, and you think, wow, I've never seen any... What? The other man comes in until finally there are three men on motorbikes going round and round inside your spare room, basically.
So you had me at Globe of Death there, but I'm guessing, having read your review of Seven Fingers,
yes,
they're
seven
calling
fingers,
it,
yep.
In the Financial Times, I'm getting the impression there's a distinct lack of three blokes at a time riding motorcycles around the inside of a big steel ball.
There is. But when the good stuff happens, it's good. I mean, the girl on the thing called the Russian Bar, doesn't that sound nice?
It does.
We'll have the bison vodka. It's a plank of wood. Two men hold it. She does the sort of thing women normally do on a 4-inch beam, you know, in the Olympics and get medals for, only on a small stage, you know, just by herself. And that was great. That was nice. I want it to be impossible. And the other warning, of course, you're obviously very in touch with your inner child. I mean, my inner child is locked herself in her room most of the time. But remember that kids under the age of about 6 think grown-ups can do anything. So they're not very impressed. You know, you have to be of an age when they know that these people can fall over. You have to know that there is a risk. Which brings us rather neatly to the Royal Ballet's Manon.
Ah, the seamless link that I was desperately trying to conjure myself.
Because,
thank you.
Because Kenneth Macmillan created these extraordinary kind of love-happy pas de deux in which, and I've seen it happen, you know, she could be dropped. She could land on her head because she's being hurled around in this kind of balletic simulation of young sexy love, you know. If you don't know the story, it's a beautiful young girl kind of explodes into this 18th century inn yard. Her brother's there to sell her to a rich old man, and this delightful young man whisks her off her feet and takes her to a hotel room, and she's kind of forever going to be torn between, you know, real love of real sex, and the possibility of a fur coat and a diamond necklace. And so she's not a very nice character, but every ballerina on earth wants to dance her. The Royal Ballet have been doing it since 1974. You can see it anywhere from Sydney to Santiago. I mean, companies just queuing up to dance it. And it's very good. And the Royal Ballet, kind of, it is something of a cash cow for the Royal Ballet. To the extent they've put on 18 performances this season, which is ambitious. So if you look in your Evening Standard in London this evening, you'll find ticket offers, which is good news because it's a great ballet and there are some great casts. Yesterday afternoon, I saw a 22-year-old girl do it for the very first time, and it was so thrilling because debuts always are. You know, there are critics, really, really pure in heart critics, who don't do debuts because they're not ready. You know, you want to give them a chance to warm up. And no, the train spotter in me wants to be there at the birth, you know, and it was tremendous.
Manon at the Royal Ballet, well worth seeing by the sound of it. Louise Levine, thank you as ever for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks also to our earlier guests, Martin Plout and Brett Mason. Today's show was produced by Isabel Kaiser, researched by David Pleasant and Max Koshik, and our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next up, after the headlines, the entrepreneurs at 2200, me and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.